This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN. As church-going slides in the United States, has a passionate, almost religious politics replaced it?
We've seen our politics become extremely polarized, almost like a sectarian war. I mean, it starts to look like Northern Ireland or the Shia versus the Sunnis. I mean, people just at their throats.
That's ahead on the show. And you'll hear how the Palestinian cause plays out in Southeast Asia. First, though, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was married in a private ceremony at the weekend. But the occasion turned controversial after the revelation that Johnson, who's divorced, had a Catholic wedding in Westminster Cathedral. Priests are now asking why they have to turn away other divorced Catholics who are desperate to remarry. And then there's the possible constitutional hitch of an officially Protestant Britain having its first Catholic Prime Minister. Christopher Lamb is Vatican correspondent for The Tablet.
Boris Johnson is twice divorced, and for many Catholics there was a question about how it was possible for him to receive a church wedding, let alone a cathedral wedding, given that for a large number of divorcees who are Catholics who wish to remarry in the church, it's simply not possible to have a church wedding because of the Catholic view and ruling against divorce. But it turns out that Boris Johnson was within his rights to have a church wedding because, according to canon law, the church's rules, his earlier marriages took place outside of the Catholic Church, and he didn't get the permissions to do that. So therefore, he was free to marry, and he is also a baptized Catholic.
But why are Catholic priests, for example, basically saying this is a very unfair situation? He's got an unfair advantage, probably because he's the Prime Minister.
I think that many priests feel concerned and upset because they've had to turn away so many divorcees who wish to have a church blessing or a church wedding. It does feel that perhaps the church is bending over backwards to the Prime Minister, and very powerful, and offering a sort of special treatment that others don't have. However, it does seem that the rules allow Boris Johnson to be married in the church, and that effectively he's been treated like anyone else. But the impression given to outsiders, I think, is that he's seems to have been allowed in through a certain loophole. And so I think that's why many priests feel that actually this case highlights the pain of those people who haven't been able to have a second marriage in a church and have had to be content with a registry office.
I understand the priest who conducted the marriage was the same priest who baptized his new child. I'm not saying it's wrong, but isn't it literally out of the order in which the Catholic Church observes things to have the baptism before the wedding? Did that not come up?
I think that is now quite common in many parishes, and I think it is for the church to baptize children regardless of the marital status of their parents. One of the other things it does raise, this case, is it appears that Britain now has its first Catholic Prime Minister. It is always understood that whilst Boris Johnson had been baptized a Catholic, he had effectively left the Catholic Church whilst at school at Eton College and had become an Anglican. However, it appears that he is now more affiliated with the Catholic Church, given, as you say, he's had his son baptised in Westminster Cathedral and has now been married there. So it suggests to me, and I think to many others, that Britain does have a Catholic Prime Minister, albeit someone who I don't think is particularly practising, although I don't want to judge his conscience on this matter, but it does appear that way.
Yes, he was confirmed as an Anglican as a teenager. So what's the situation? The Catholic Church argues that your Catholic baptism never lapses. It doesn't matter if you tinker with other denominations. They still won't let you go. I mean, yeah, this is a fascinating point.
It seems like that. So according to the church rules, even if you decide to become confirmed as an Anglican, that doesn't necessarily negate your Catholic baptism. Now, I believe that if you formally defect from the church, that is accepted. You know, the Catholic Church doesn't cling on even if you've formally decided to leave. But I think you have to declare that in a way that is different from simply becoming the member of another church. Also, in Boris Johnson's case, he had to indicate, although I was baptized a Catholic, I never meant to leave the Catholic Church when I became an Anglican. That also is what allowed him to get married in the Catholic Church, because if he had formally left the Catholic Church, then he wouldn't have been allowed to have his latest marriage, because his first marriage would have been seen as valid. That's my understanding of the rules.
Christopher, you've raised a really interesting political, almost constitutional point here, because if Boris Johnson is, in effect, Britain's first Catholic Prime Minister, does that raise any constitutional questions in a country that has as its official state church the Church of England, the Anglican Protestant Church?
It does raise some constitutional questions, because the British Prime Minister has a role in advising the monarch, the crown, on the appointments of Anglican bishops. And it has been the case in law that it's not possible for a Catholic, a Roman Catholic, to be involved in that process. It also is the case that the rules have been slightly changed so that the Prime Minister is not going to the monarch and saying, you should appoint this bishop and that bishop. Effectively, the Prime Minister is essentially just handing over what he's been told to say to the monarch when it comes to the Church of England bishops. However, you know, we are in uncharted territory with the first Catholic Prime Minister.
I wonder whether the controversy over the perceived unfairness of the Prime Minister, a two-time divorcee, being afforded a Catholic wedding, might prompt some sympathetic revisiting of this issue in the Vatican. We know that Pope Francis is more sympathetic to this idea. It got him into a lot of trouble 4 or 5 years ago. How do you think the Vatican might react?
Pope Francis has, as you say, was tried to be much more welcoming to divorced and remarried Catholics, to allow them to receive communion, for example, and has been opposed quite vociferously in some quarters as a result of that. And so I think the Pope's vision of the church is one of which welcomes people, understands the complex realities of people's lives. Not all families are the same, and that people's marriages break down, etc. He's very understanding and sympathetic on that point. So I think that if the church's rules have been followed, I don't see why he would have any problem with this. At the same time, I think he might be a little concerned if the church was being brought into sort of any kind of political battle. It seems that following the wedding of Mr. and Mrs. Johnson, friends of Carrie Johnson are saying it was a victory in a Downing Street political turf war with Boris Johnson's former advisor. So I think he would be concerned about any kind of politicisation here.
Let me read you something that one of your colleagues who covers the Vatican as well, Austin Ivory, wrote. He referred to the Prime Minister, a twice divorced nominal Anglican who has gained some notoriety for his extramarital affairs. There's almost an echo here of what people used to say about certain evangelicals in the United States and their attitude to a certain former president, another twice divorced leader. I mean, it does raise this issue about whether religious denominations really just like, if you like, the celebrity appeal of some of these people, regardless of their adherence to doctrine.
I think the church has to be very careful when it comes too close to power and to powerful individuals and figures. There are always lots of pitfalls, and I think that's where there needs to be caution. In this case, it seems as if Boris Johnson's situation has been judged according to the rules rather than any special treatment. But the impression is that the church is willing to sort of bend over backwards for the most powerful.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but I think the Prime Minister now has 6 children, 5 of them born outside of a Catholic relationship. Does this suggest the Catholic Church is less concerned with what, in rather blunt, old-fashioned terms, it used to call fornication?
I think with Boris Johnson, there is a interesting historical analogy. Some people liken Boris to King Henry VIII. Like King Henry, Boris has led what some people see as a second reformation or a second break with the continent through Brexit. King Henry, of course, broke with Rome when he decided that he wanted to divorce his first wife and marry his second. Except with Boris Johnson, he's gone even further because he's managed to get the church to recognise his third marriage. So there is, I think, an interesting historical parallel there, albeit not precise. And arguably, Boris has managed to achieve what King Henry couldn't.
That's Christopher Lamb of The Tablet, and his book is The Outsider, Pope Francis and His Battle to Reform the Church. And earlier today, Pope Francis issued a major edict designed to toughen up church laws against sexual abuse. The edict also targets fraud in the church, but more controversially, women's ordination. We'll have a deeper look at that edict on next week's Religion and Ethics Report. Tensions have cooled in Israel and Gaza after weeks of violence, but the Palestinian cause is raising the temperature of politics in Indonesia. Almost 9,000 kilometres separates Jerusalem and Jakarta, but in the world's biggest Muslim democracy, religious solidarity is a hot issue. Johannes Negrono is a journalist and occasional analyst with the Lowy Institute. He's based in Surabaya.
President Jokowi, I mean, when he first ran for president in 2014, he did say in his manifesto that he would make Palestine a priority in Indonesia's foreign policy. The Palestinian cause has been a cornerstone policy, really, for Indonesia's foreign policy for decades, and reiterated it. And he did some sort of rhetorical work when Indonesia assumed its position as a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council, but nothing much was achieved, as was expected. And our vice president happens to be now a Muslim cleric, and he was and has been quite vocal about his support for Palestine.
But do the parties try to outdo each other in their pro-Palestinian rhetoric?
Oh, yes. Indonesia is a country where social media is very popular. Most of the population are social media users, and different politicians try to outdo each other, basically, on social media, you know, expressing their support for Palestine. And some have even started fundraising campaigns. In real terms, Indonesia cannot really influence events in Israel or Palestine. But he was playing to the domestic audience, basically.
Yes, and what is the attitude of Indonesia's population when it comes to Israel?
I think most Indonesians would have a negative attitude towards Israel, partly because the political Islam here has embraced the Palestinian cause, and it's basically preached from every mosque, you know, in Indonesia, across the country. I mean, the imams would preach as Muslims that they have to support Palestine. It's a question of Muslim solidarity. That's affected the attitude of most Indonesians towards Israel.
Yeah, what did a BBC World Service poll find when it came to Indonesian attitudes on Israel?
It found that more than 60% of Indonesians were sort of strongly opposed to Israel and its occupation of Palestine. That would be the attitude of most Muslims here. And the only one supporting Israel would be the Christians. especially the evangelicals.
What relationship do Israel and Indonesia, which is the world's biggest Muslim country, have? Do they have any relationship at all?
Not formally. Indonesia has refused to recognize the state of Israel since its foundation, basically. And there is no formal diplomatic link whatsoever. But Indonesia does import weaponry and hardware from Israel. But this is hush-hush. I mean, no Indonesian will talk about it. And it's probably denied by the government if it's asked. Yeah, so no formal relation. And Indonesia has said that it will not recognize Israel unless the Palestinian state has gained its independence.
So we do know that Israel is selling arms to Indonesia.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, this has been going on since the days of Suharto, so it's been going on for decades. Hardware, military hardware. Last year, for example, Indonesia exported goods from Israel in the amount of $50 million or something. But it's usually hidden from the public by the government. It's not really something they would talk about. And unfortunately, the anti-Israel attitude has been translated into anti-Semitism as well here in Indonesia.
Well, where has that manifested itself?
In my hometown, Surabaya, you know, we had a Jewish synagogue. It's actually a heritage building because it dated back to the Dutch era. It was demolished a few years ago by the government. And lots of activists from the historical societies and stuff protested against the demolition, but the government didn't seem to care. It looked like it wanted to erase any Jewish trace, you know, from our histories. There were some vibrant Jewish communities here in the days of the Dutch.
Is there any discernible Jewish community in Indonesia?
There are small pockets, and there are actually Indonesian converts to Judaism. I mean, I've met a few. They mostly live in urban areas, and they wouldn't be too open about their faith because that might expose them to prejudice.
What sort of material support, though, does Indonesia actually provide, for example, to Palestinians?
Mostly humanitarian support through the government and public subscriptions. It's in the amount of millions of dollars. 7 million or something last year.
That's Indonesia analyst Yohannes Nugroho. And you're with me, Andrew West. As traditional religion declines in the US, are people replacing it with a religious-like devotion to politics? Maybe it's Old Testament-style representations of Donald Trump or atheist versions of the nativity scene featuring George Washington. Linda Feldman is a senior writer at the Christian Science Monitor. She has the cover story in the June issue of the magazine titled, Is Politics the New Religion?
For the first time in 8 decades of polling, American membership in religious congregations, be it a church or a mosque or a synagogue, has dropped below 50%. The numbers have had a particular decline in the last 20 years. So between, say, 1999, church participation, religious participation was 70%, 70. It is now 47%. We've seen a rise in the so-called nuns, which is atheists, agnostics, and people of no particular religious faith. At the same time, we've seen our politics become extremely polarized, almost like a sectarian war. I mean, it starts to look like Northern Ireland or the Shia versus the Sunnis. I mean, people just at their throats, each other's throats. And that was obviously evident on January 6th when we had the insurrection in the Capitol.
Not just polarized, though, Linda, because as you point out in this cover story for the Christian Science Monitor magazine, politics is also becoming more ritualized. And this is one of the things that I found so fascinating about your piece. How have rituals, religious-style rituals, become commonplace in politics?
Well, they've become quite commonplace. On January the 6th, when the Trump supporters invaded the Capitol in a quixotic effort to overturn the result of the election, there were people carrying Bibles, people carrying other religious paraphernalia, Confederate flags, which, of course, that's not a religious symbol, but It's a symbol of belief. You know, if you believe in a particular image of America, America is a white Christian nation, that would might be your symbol. One thing I didn't mention in this story, there was a gathering in Florida not long after January 6th at which Donald Trump spoke, and there was a golden statue of Donald Trump at that event. It was somebody just pointed this out to me, and I thought, absolutely, yes. Very much a kind of religious, a graven image of Donald Trump.
The golden calf.
The golden calf. And here's Donald Trump, who a very large percentage of his voters believe was divinely tapped to become president.
I hadn't noticed that golden image of Donald Trump. But yes, the graven image. Now, what really took me was one of the people that you interviewed, Mandy, not her real name, but she has actually replaced church attendance with Trump rally attendance. Is that right?
It is. She described in her participation in the events at the Capitol, she didn't see herself as an invader, but she went to that and she talked about going to 20 other Trump rallies over the years since 2016 in a way that struck me as a kind of secular communion. She said she loves to go to these things because of the people. Yes, it's about Donald Trump, but it's also about being with like-minded people. And that is something that a lot of people get from going to a religious service once a week. You get that regular sense of being with other people and having the same beliefs.
But when people go in the past to their local parish or to their local synagogue, for example, you could often, as recently maybe as 20 years ago, rely on meeting people from the opposite party and having very civil relations, really warm friendships with people from a different political view who came to the same parish or religious congregation. What's now happened?
We're seeing in some major denominations, I'm thinking in particular of evangelical churches, that people who have decided that they can no longer support Donald Trump have also decided they have to leave that church, either that or hide their political views, that churches and houses of worship have become increasingly partisan, and that people just aren't comfortable if they don't share the same political views as the other people in that congregation. This is a new thing. It used to be that politics stopped at the doorstep, but now it has very much entered the milieu of worship and of who you hang out with. It's part of the larger phenomenon of people just not associating with those from the other party. The gulf has gotten that wide.
You point out that social media has in fact replaced the church in offering points of connection. But ironically, I guess, social media just reinforces the closed loop, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, people increasingly in this country are living in ideological silos, whether it be the news channels they watch or the social media channels that they pay attention to or, in fact, congregate in, whether it's Facebook or Telegram or some of these other places, even in the dark web, where people congregate and share opinions. And that, of course, is where QAnon has really blossomed. I view that as also a form of religion, where there's a lot of faith involved. I mean, it's a conspiracy theory, and it, of course, isn't true. It's this kind of view that there's this satanic effort in the, quote, deep state that was trying to undermine Donald Trump when he was president. A lot of people believe in that, and that was very prevalent, and there were a lot of signs and symbols of that also on January the 6th.
Let's talk about this phenomenon also on the left. What has happened, for example, to the Black Church movement? It was the engine room of civil rights activism, the Black Church. But you say it's being displaced a bit. In what way?
The Black Lives Matter movement, which has really driven Black activism in recent years and was the engine of protest, that's been replaced by people who they say they're Marxists, and in Marxist thought, atheism is the, sort of the highest expression of belief, that you become so educated and so sort of developed in your thought that you don't need God. In the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, Martin Luther King Jr. was the most prominent person, and there were many, many from the Black Church. That's where it really emanated from. This is not to say that the Black Church isn't still important, but it is declining in activity, particularly among young African Americans. This is not to suggest that it's gone completely. There are a lot of Black pastors who have been involved, you know, in the protests over George Floyd and the continuing protests for racial equity and for social justice. In fact, one of our newest senators, Raphael Warnock, he was the chief pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to overstate the decline of the Black Church, but it is reflecting the larger trends in American society.
Tell me about this group, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and quite frankly, a very religious scene that they have enacted.
Right. No, I love this. So the Freedom From Religion Foundation has been around for years. They represent atheists, agnostics, and other people who believe that the freedom of religion in this country, as enshrined in the First Amendment to our Constitution, also guarantees the freedom from religion. There has to be a sharp separation, and that people can't be forced to worship or, you know, have to participate in anything that's religious. I spoke with the head of their chapter in Sacramento, California, who told me that every year they put what looks like a nativity scene at the state capitol in California. But it's instead of Jesus and Mary in the manger, it's the founding fathers signing the Bill of Rights. And here's the punchline. The Bill of Rights were signed in December of that year, 1791, and therefore it fits in with all the other religious holidays that happen in December, Christmas and Hanukkah.
On the Religion and Ethics Report, we're speaking with Linda Feldman. She's a senior writer with the Christian Science Monitor. Linda's the author of a new cover story for the magazine, Is Politics the New Religion? Also on the left, there's been what you and others in this article describe as a kind of quasi-religion around the idea of being woke, awakened to social injustice. How has that taken on religious forms?
There's a level of absolutism there with being woke, and that feeds also into the whole anti-racism movement, in which you have to follow a certain orthodoxy in the words that you use and in the attitudes that you hold.
But I'm just thinking, you give this picture of certain liberal neighborhoods in the United States. What are the sort of signs that you might see, street signs or lawn signs?
There are these rainbow-hued signs that appear quite frequently that list a set of principles. In this house, we believe Black lives matter, women's rights are human rights, love is love, science is real, and on and on. You know, on one level, it's hard to argue with these values, but it is quasi-religious for all these lawns to have basically the same signs. I mean, I've never, frankly, seen anything like this before.
One of the most troubling things that you report in this piece, and it is a concern that's actually shared by an awful lot of religious leaders, is the idea that some politicians claim their elections to be ordained by God. How damaging has that been, both to politics and to faith?
The belief that Donald Trump was ordained by God to be president, that belief rose actually quite dramatically by his final year in office. I mean, some people see his presidency as almost a cult of personality. He had a lot of garden variety Republican support, people who looked at him a bit askance, but voted for him anyway. But then he had people who he either brought them over from the Democratic Party, or people who just weren't politically engaged at all, and who suddenly found somebody who was saying things that resonated with them, anti-immigrant and kind of xenophobic, and America First was his big slogan. And this whole belief system really led to a bit of a deification.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of his press secretary or former press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who herself is now running for governor. I think she kept saying that there's no doubt that he, with a capital H, that is God, meant for Donald Trump to be president.
Yes, she said that. And I even double checked to make sure that she said that while she was press secretary. And she, in fact, did. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is herself an evangelical Christian, and largely kept that away from her work as press secretary. But that was a moment when she kind of let that dividing line go.
Just finally, Linda, you refer to the 17th century theologian Blaise Pascal, and it's a particularly apposite quote because it looks at this idea of politics replacing religion. What did Blaise Pascal observe?
He conceptualized something that came to be known as the God-shaped whole, which is the idea that all humans contain a so-called infinite abyss that can only be filled basically by God himself. So this, I think, feeds into this idea that all humans have to have some form of religion, meaning some kind of belief system. Pascal suggests that it's God, that there is actually God that fills that hole. I know atheists who absolutely disagree with that, but what's interesting to me about Pascal is that not only was he a theologian, he was a mathematician. And mathematicians are so thoroughly logical and left brain that for him to have this idea of a God-shaped hole is especially interesting, that he doesn't need to see visual proof of God, but he knows God is there.
That's Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor. And we'll put a link to her story at our program website. And that is the program for this week. You can follow us at the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Mudita Dias and Bryce Halliday. I'm Andrew West. The Religion and Ethics Report is back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.